As far as the eye could see, the downward slope had ended, and I was walking up a gentle rise. I picked my way forward, unsure of my direction. I checked my watch, but its hands held no meaning. One glance told me that much. In fact, nothing I carried, keyring, wallet, driver's license, loose change, handkerchief, promised to be of any use at all. The incline grew steeper and steeper. After a while, I was literally crawling up the slope on my hands and knees. If I could only reach the top, then maybe I could see where I was. I pushed on without pausing to catch my breath. The only sound was the sound I was making, and even that seemed artificial, not like real sound at all. There was nothing alive that I could see. Not a tree, not a clump of grass, not a solitary bird, not even a puff of wind. Only I moved. All else was still. It was as if time itself had come to a halt. I finally reached the top of the rise. I could see in all directions from there as I had anticipated, yet my view was limited, for there was a whitish mist that hung over everything. All I could make out was what amounted to a lifeless wasteland, a craggy, barren wilderness that stretched in every direction. There was no true sky, just that milky white ceiling. I felt like an astronaut who had crashed and landed on an uninhabited planet. Well, at least there was some light and air that I could breathe. I should be grateful for those. I could find no sign of life. Finally, though, I was able to make out a faint sound. I thought it might be a hallucination at first, or possibly coming from my own body. Yet it gradually became clear that the noise was continuous and caused by some kind of natural phenomenon. In fact, it sounded like flowing water. Perhaps it was the river that Longface had spoken of. Bathed in the pale light, I picked my way down the bumpy slope in the direction of the sound. The sound of water made me terribly thirsty. Come to think of it, I had been walking a very long time with nothing to drink, yet I had been so anxious that water had never crossed my mind. Now, I craved it desperately. But was the water in that river, if that was where the sound was coming from, drinkable? It might be thick with mud or filled with dangerous toxins, or perhaps it was metaphorical water, which my hands could not scoop up. Oh well, I would find out when I got there. The noise grew louder and clearer as I went along. It sounded like a fast-flowing river tumbling through rocks, yet I still could not see it. As I headed toward the sound, the ground on both sides of me rose until I was walking between two rock walls about 30 feet in height. The path cut between those towering cliffs, though its serpentine twists and turns made it impossible to know what lay ahead. It was not a man-made trail. Rather, it appeared to have been fashioned by the forces of nature. From what I could tell, the river lay at its end. I hurried along the walled path. I passed no tree, no blade of grass, not a living thing. The silent cliffs were all that I could see, a sterile, monochrome world. It was as if an artist had lost interest in painting a landscape and had abandoned it before adding the colors. I could barely hear my own footsteps. The rocks seemed to absorb sound. At a certain point, the path, which had been flat for the most part, began to slope upward again. It took some time, but at last I reached the crest, which ran like a spine along the top of the cliffs. When I leaned forward, I could see the river. Now the rush of water was even more audible. The river was not especially wide, maybe 15 or 20 feet across, but its current was swift. I couldn't tell its depth. Judging from the white caps it sent up here and there, boulders and other hidden obstacles lay beneath the surface. The river carved a straight line through the rocky terrain. I crossed the ridge and headed down the slope in its direction. When I reached the river and saw it rushing past from right to left, I felt much better. At the very least, a large quantity of water was on the move. It had originated somewhere and was flowing somewhere else, following the contours of the land. In a place where nothing stirred and no wind blew, the sound of rushing water reverberated around me. No, this world was not wholly absent of motion. That fact alone gave me some comfort. The moment I reached the river, I knelt on the bank and scooped up water in my cupped hands. It was pleasantly cold. The river seemed snow-fed. Its water was crystal clear and appeared pure. Of course, I couldn't tell by looking at it if it was safe to drink. It might contain a deadly poison, or bacteria that would ravage my body. I sniffed the water in my hands. It had no odor, that is, if my sense of smell was still functioning. I took a sip. It had no flavor, that is, if I hadn't lost my sense of taste. I braced myself and swallowed deeply. I was too thirsty to resist, whatever the consequences. The water was indeed entirely tasteless and odorless. It might be real or fabricated, but thankfully, it would quench my thirst. I knelt there, blissfully gulping mouthful after mouthful. I was thirstier than I had realized, yet it was strange somehow to drink water lacking in taste and odor. Cold water, when we are thirsty, is delicious more than anything else. Our body sucks it in greedily. Our cells rejoice. Our muscles regain their strength. Yet drinking the water from this river brought none of those feelings. It did no more than quench my thirst at a simple physical level. When I had drunk my fill, I stood up and looked at my surroundings one more time. Longface had said that there would be a boat landing somewhere along the riverbank, that one of the boats could ferry me to the other side. There I would, probably, find information relating to Maria Akikawa's whereabouts, but I could see nothing that looked like a landing, either upstream or downstream. I would have to search for it. A boat was crucial. Fording the river unaided was too dangerous. "The water is cold and deep, and the current is strong. You cannot cross without a boat," Longface had told me. But which way should I turn to find that boat? Upriver or downriver? I had to choose one or the other. Then I remembered Menshiki's given name, Wataru, written with the kanji for traversing water. The Wataru in my name is the character that means to cross a river, Menshiki had said when he introduced himself. I don't know why I was given that name. I've never had much to do with water. A short while later, he had added, "By the way, I'm left-handed. If I'm told to go left or right, I always choose left. It's become a habit." It was a random comment, quite disconnected to what we were talking about. I couldn't figure out why he would blurt out something like that, which is probably why it stuck in my mind. Maybe his comment had no special significance. It could have been mere happenstance. Yet, according to Longface, this was a land built upon the conjunction of phenomena and expression. I ought to be able to handle the happenstance of any hints that came in my direction. I stood before the river and made up my mind. I would go left. If I took the unconscious tip that colorless Menshiki had provided and followed the tasteless, odorless river downstream, it might provide a further hint of some sort. Then again, it might not. As I walked along the riverbank, I wondered what, if anything, lived in the water. It didn't seem likely anything did. I couldn't confirm this, of course. Nevertheless, I could see no signs of life. What organism would live in water that had neither taste nor odor? The river appeared wholly concentrated on its own identity. "I am river," it said. "I am that which flows." Certainly, it possessed the form of a river, but beyond that state of being, there was nothing. Not a thing floated on its surface, not a twig, not a blade of grass. It was simply a great quantity of water cutting across the land. I pushed on through that boundless, cottony mist. It gently resisted me as I moved, like a filmy curtain of white lace. After a while, my gut began to react to the water I had drunk. It didn't feel unpleasant or ominous, but neither was it cause for rejoicing. A neutral feeling, whose true nature eluded my understanding. I felt I was being somehow changed, as if I were no longer the same person. It was a strange sensation. Could the water be turning me into someone physically adapted to this world? For some reason, though, I was able to stay calm. I thought optimistically that there could be no real harm. My optimism had no firm basis. Nevertheless, I had passed without mishap through the narrow pitch-black passageway. With neither map nor compass, I had crossed a rocky wilderness to find this river. I had quenched my thirst with its water. I had avoided a close encounter with a lurking double metaphor. Dumb luck? Or perhaps it was predetermined. Whichever the case, I was heading in a good direction. So I thought. Or at least, so I tried to convince myself. Finally, a vague shape appeared through the haze. It was not a natural object. Its straight lines meant it had to be human-made. As I drew nearer, I saw that it was a boat landing, a small wooden jetty extending from the shore. Turning left had been the correct decision. Then again, it was possible that, in a world governed by connectivity, things would shift to accommodate whatever action I chose. Apparently, Manshiki's unconscious hint had helped steer me through to this point. I could see the figure of a man, shrouded in the mist. He was tall. In fact, after the tiny Commendatore and Longface, he looked like a giant. He was standing very still at the end of the jetty, as if lost in thought, leaning against some kind of dark machine. The swift, flowing river bubbled over his feet. He was the first human being I had encountered in this land, or human-shaped being, perhaps. I approached him with trepidation. I couldn't see him clearly, so I took a chance and called out, "Hello!" through that cottony veil. But there was no reply. He just adjusted his posture slightly. I could see his dark silhouette shift in the mist. Perhaps my voice hadn't reached him. The sound of the river might have blotted it out, or the air in these parts might not carry sound very well. "Hello," I said again, moving somewhat closer, in a louder voice this time. Still, he didn't speak. All I could hear was the unbroken rush of water. Perhaps he couldn't understand what I was saying.
"I can hear you, and I do understand," he said, as if reading my mind. His voice was deep and low, befitting his height, but it was also flat, utterly devoid of feeling, just as the river was devoid of odor and taste.
Chapter 54. Eternity is a very long time. The tall man standing before me had no face. He did have a head, of course. It sat on his shoulders in a normal way, but the head lacked a face. Where a face should have been was blank, a milky blankness like pale smoke. His voice emerged from within that emptiness like wind from a deep cavern. The man was wearing what looked like a dark raincoat. The coat ended just short of the ground, so I could see the tips of his boots peeking out. Its buttons were fastened up to his neck. It was as if there was a storm on the horizon, and he had dressed for it. I stood there, rooted to the spot, unable to speak. From a distance, he had reminded me of the man with the white Subaru Forester, or Tomohiko Amada the night he had visited my studio, or again, the young man who slayed the Commendatore with his sword in killing Commendatore. All were similarly tall. A closer look, however, told me he was none of them. He was just the faceless man. A broad-brimmed black hat was pulled low over his eyes. The brim half concealed the milky emptiness.
I can hear you, and I do understand, he repeated. I didn't see his lips move, of course. He had none.
Is this the boat landing? I asked.
Yes, the faceless man replied. This is the boat landing. Only from here can one cross the river.
I must travel to the other side.
As must all.
Do many come? The man did not reply. My question was sucked into the void. There followed an interminable silence. What is on the other side? I asked. The white mist over the river concealed the far shore. I could feel the faceless man studying my face from within the emptiness.
What is on the other side depends on what you are seeking. It is different for everyone.
I am trying to locate the whereabouts of a young girl named Maria Akikawa.
So that is what you seek on the other side, correct?
Yes, that is what I seek. That is why I have come.
And how was it, then, that you were able to find the entrance?
I killed an idea that had taken the form of the Commendatore. I killed him with a carving knife in a nursing home in Izukogen. I did so with his permission. His death summoned Long Face, the metaphor who opened the hole to the underground passageway. I forced him to let me in. The man fixed his empty countenance on me for some time. He didn't speak. Had he understood me or not? I couldn't tell.
Was there blood?
A great deal, I answered.
Actual blood, I take it.
So it seemed.
Look at your hands.
I looked, but no trace of blood remained. Perhaps it had been washed away when I drank from the river. There ought to have been a lot, though.
No matter, the faceless man said. I have a boat, and I will ferry you across. But there is one condition.
I waited to be told what that might be.
You must pay me an appropriate fee. That is the rule.
And if I can't pay, am I unable to cross to the far shore?
Yes. You would have to remain here for eternity. The river is cold and deep, and the current is strong. And eternity is a very long time. That is no figure of speech, I assure you.
But I have nothing to pay you with.
Show me what is in your pockets,
the faceless man said in a quiet voice. I emptied my jacket and pants pockets. My wallet contained slightly less than 20,000 yen, my credit card, my bank card, my driver's license, and a gas station discount coupon. My key ring with three keys on it, a cream-colored handkerchief, and a disposable ballpoint pen, 5 or 6 coins, and that was it, minus the flashlight, of course. The faceless man shook his head.
I'm sorry, but I see nothing that can pay for your passage. Money has no meaning here. Don't you have something else?
I had nothing more in my possession. A cheap watch was on my left wrist, but time had no value here either. If you give me paper, I can portray your likeness. My skill as a painter is the only other thing I carry with me. The faceless man laughed. At least I think he did. A faint trill echoed in the emptiness.
In the first place, I have no face. How can you sketch the likeness of a man with no face? Can you draw a void?
I am a professional, I said. I have no need of a face to draw your portrait. I wasn't at all sure I could pull it off, but I figured it was worth a shot.
I would be most interested to see what you come up with,
the faceless man said.
Unfortunately, there is no paper in these parts.
I looked down at the ground. Perhaps I could scratch something on its surface with a stick, but it was solid rock. I shook my head.
Are you certain that is all you carry with you?
I carefully searched a second time. The pockets of my leather jacket were empty, completely. I did find something small tucked in the bottom of one of my jeans pockets, though, a tiny plastic penguin. Menshiki had picked it up from the floor of the pit and given it to me. It had an even tinier strap, which Maria had used to fasten it to her cell phone. It was her lucky charm. Somehow, it had fallen into the pit.
Show me what is in your hand,
the faceless man said. I opened my hand, revealing the figurine. The faceless man stared at it with empty eyes.
This will do, he said after a moment. I will accept this as payment.
Should I hand it over or not? It was Maria's precious lucky charm, after all. It wasn't mine. Could I just give it away? What if something bad happened to her as a result? But I had no choice. If I failed to turn it over, I would never reach the opposite shore. And if I didn't reach the shore, then I would never find Maria. The Commendatore's death would have been in vain. I will give you the penguin as my fare of passage, I said. Please take me to the other side of the river. The faceless man nodded.
The day may come when you can draw my likeness, he said. If that day arrives, I will return the penguin to you.
The faceless man strode to the end of the wooden jetty and stepped down into the small boat moored there. It was a rectangular vessel shaped like a pastry box. Barely 6 feet long and narrow and made of heavy wooden boards, I doubted it could carry many passengers at a time. There was a thick mast in the middle of the boat, at the top of which stood a metal ring about 4 inches in diameter. A sturdy rope was threaded through that ring. The rope stretched across the river to the far shore in a straight line. It barely sagged at all. It appeared that the boat ran back and forth along that rope, which kept it from being swept away by the swift current. The boat looked as if it had been in use for ages. It had no visible means of propulsion, or even a proper prow. It was just a shallow wooden box floating on the water. I followed the faceless man into the boat and seated myself on the horizontal plank that ran from side to side. He leaned against the thick mast with his eyes closed, as if waiting for something. Neither of us spoke. After a few minutes, as if it had made up its own mind, the boat began its slow departure. I had no idea what was propelling us, but we were moving silently toward the far shore. There was no sound of an engine, nor of any other machinery. All I could hear was the steady slapping of water against the hull. We moved at roughly the pace of someone walking. Our boat was dashed from side to side by the current, but the sturdy rope prevented us from being washed downstream. It was just as the faceless man had said. No one could cross the river without a boat. He leaned calmly against the mast, unperturbed even when it felt like our craft might capsize. "Will I be able to find Maria Akikawa when we reach the other side?" I asked, when we were about halfway across.
"I am here to ferry you across the river," the faceless man said, "to help you navigate the interstice between presence and absence. After that, it's up to you. My job is done."
Not long after, we hit the jetty on the far shore with a small bump. The faceless man's posture, however, did not change. He leaned against the mast, as if confirming some sort of internal process. When that was done, he expelled a great, empty breath and stepped up onto the jetty. I followed him out of the boat. The jetty and the winch-like mechanism attached to it were the same as those on the opposite bank. So similar, in fact, it felt as if we had made a round trip and ended back where we started. That feeling disappeared, however, the moment I stepped on shore. For the ground on this side was normal earth, not solid rock.
"You must proceed alone from here," the faceless man announced.
"But I don't know which path to take, or which direction to go."
"Such things are inconsequential here," came the rumble from the milky void. "You have drunk from the river, have you not? Now each of your actions will generate an equivalent response in accordance with the principle of connectivity. Such is the place you have come to."
With these words, the faceless man adjusted his wide-brimmed hat, turned on his heel, and walked back to his boat. Once he was aboard, it returned as it had come, following the rope to the other side, slow and sure, like a well-trained animal. The faceless man and the boat were one as they vanished into the mist. I decided to leave the jetty behind and walk downstream along the bank. I could have gone in any direction, but it seemed best to follow the river. That way, there was water to drink when I got thirsty. A short while later, I turned to look back at the jetty, but it was already cloaked in white mist, as though it had never existed. The farther I walked, the wider the river became, and the gentler the current. There were no more whitecaps, and the sound of rushing water had practically disappeared. Why hadn't they put the pier here instead of where the flow was so swift? True, the distance would have been greater, but the crossing would have been so much easier where the water was calm. All the same, this world probably operated according to its own principles, its own way of thinking. Even greater danger might lurk beneath the placid surface. I searched my pockets. Sure enough, the penguin was gone. That the protective charm had been lost, most likely for all eternity, was hardly reassuring. Perhaps I had made the wrong choice, yet what other option did I have? I could only hope Maria would be all right without it. At this point, hope was all I had. I made my way along the riverbank, the flashlight from Tomohiko Amada's bedside in one hand. I kept it turned off. This dusky world was not so dim as to require a light. I could see where I was walking, and for about 12 or 15 feet ahead. The river flowed to my left, slow and silent. Once in a while, I could glimpse the far shore through the haze. The farther on I pushed, the more the ground beneath my feet came to resemble a path. Not a well-defined path, yet something that fulfilled the function of a path. There were vague signs that people had passed this way before. Gradually, the path was leading me away from the river. At a certain point, I drew up short. Should I stick to the river, or allow this presumed path to take me in another direction? After some thought, I elected to follow the path and leave the river behind. I had a feeling it would lead me somewhere.
Now each of your actions will generate an equivalent response in accordance with the principle of connectivity, the ferryman had said.
This path could well be an example. I decided to follow the plausible suggestion, if that's what it was, that had been presented to me. The farther I moved from the river, the more the path turned uphill. Eventually, I realized I could no longer hear the rush of water. The slope was easy and the path almost straight, so my steps fell into a steady rhythm. The mist was melting away, but the light remained pale and somewhat opaque. There was no way to tell what lay ahead. I kept my eyes on my feet and my breathing regular and systematic.
How long had I been walking? I had lost all sense of time, all sense of direction, too. And the thoughts running through my head were distracting me. I had so much to figure out, yet my thoughts had become so terribly fragmented.
When I tried to focus on one thought, a new thought would appear to gulp it down, and my mind would careen in the wrong direction. Each time, I lost track of what I had just been thinking about. I was so distracted, in fact, that I almost bumped right into that. I tripped on something and raised my eyes as I was regaining my balance. In that instant, the air around me was transformed. I could feel it on my skin. I snapped back to reality. An enormous black mass loomed directly ahead. My jaw dropped in surprise. What was it? It took a moment to register that a huge forest stood in my path. It had materialized without warning in a terrain that, until that point, had had no vegetation, not a single leaf or blade of grass. No mystery, then, why I was so shocked. It was a forest, no question there. A tangle of branches with thick leaves that formed a solid wall. Within the forest was darkness. More accurate than forest, perhaps, might have been sea of trees. I stood before it and listened, but could hear nothing. No bird songs, no branches rustling in the wind. A complete absence of sound. I was afraid to step inside the forest. Instinctively. The trees were too dense, the darkness inside too deep. I had no way to gauge the scale or how far the path would continue. It might well split into a labyrinth of side trails. If I got lost in that maze, my chances of escaping were practically zero. Still, I had no other real options. The path I had chosen headed straight into the forest, or more accurately, was sucked into it, like train tracks are sucked into a tunnel. It made no sense, having come this far, to turn around and head back to the river. Who knows, the river might not even be there anymore. No, I had made my choice, and now I had to live with it. I would press on at whatever cost. Mustering my courage, I stepped into the trees. It was impossible to tell the time of day. It could have been dawn, or midday, or evening. The half-light never seemed to vary, no matter how much time passed. Then again, time might not exist in this world. In which case, this dusk could persist, day in and day out, forever. Sure enough, it was dark inside. The layered branches above my head blocked out almost all light, yet I left my flashlight off. Once my eyes adjusted, I could see enough to walk, and I didn't want to waste the batteries. I plunged through the forest, trying hard to empty my mind. Any thoughts would likely lead me to an even darker place. The path continued its gentle rise. All I could hear were my own footsteps, and those were more and more faint, as if their sound was slowly being sucked away. I hoped my thirst wouldn't return. By this time, the river would be far indeed. No chance of heading back for a drink, however thirsty I got. How long did I walk? The forest was deep and dark, the view unchanging. The light never changed either. My footsteps were all I could hear, and barely at that. The air was tasteless and odorless, as always. Thick trees walled both sides of the path. I could see nothing else. Did anything live here? Perhaps not. I had noticed no birds or insects. Yet I could feel something watching me. The sensation was clear and very unpleasant. Sharp eyes were being trained in my direction from behind the wall of foliage. Every movement I made was under surveillance. My skin burned as if under a magnifying glass in the sun. What was I doing there? They demanded. This was their domain, and I was a lone invader. Yet I never actually saw any of those eyes. I may have imagined them. Fear and suspicion can fashion eyes in the dark. Then again, Maria had felt Manshiki's eyes on her from across a valley, and through a telescope, no less. She had guessed that someone was keeping constant watch on her, and she was right. Those eyes were no fantasy. Nevertheless, I decided to dismiss the eyes I felt scrutinizing me. There was no way that they were real. They had to be hallucinations, created by my fears. I needed to think that way. I had to make it through the great forest, though its actual size was a mystery, while retaining as much of my sanity as possible. Luckily, there were no side trails. Thus, I wasn't forced to make a choice that might take me into a maze that led nowhere. No thorny thickets blocked my way. All I had to do was push forward along a single path. I couldn't tell how long I had been walking, yet I didn't feel especially tired. Perhaps I was under too much stress to register fatigue. Just when my legs were getting a little heavy, however, I spied a yellow point of light in the distance. At first, I thought it was a firefly, but I was mistaken. The light didn't move or flicker on and off. Its fixed position suggested that it was human-made. The farther I went, little by little, the light grew larger and brighter. There could be no doubt. I was approaching something. Was it something good or something bad? Would it help or harm me? Whichever, I was out of options. For better or for worse, I had to find out what that light was. If I didn't have the guts to do that, I never should have embarked on this journey in the first place. Step by step, I advanced toward the light. Then, just as suddenly as it had appeared before me, the forest ended. The trees that had lined the path on both sides vanished, and before I knew it, I had stepped out into a broad clearing. The clearing was the shape of a half moon and perfectly level. Now I could see the sky once more and view my surroundings in that dusky light. Directly across from me rose a sheer cliff, and at the base of that cliff was the open mouth of a dark cave. The yellow light I had been following streamed directly from that opening. The gloomy sea of trees was behind me, the towering cliff, much too steep for me to climb, straight ahead. The mouth of the cave opened directly before me. I looked up at the sky a second time, then around at my surroundings. Nothing looked like a path. My next move had to be to enter the cave. There was no alternative. Before going in, I took several deep breaths to brace myself. By moving forward, I would generate a new reality in accordance with the principle of connectivity. So the faceless man had said, I would navigate the interstice between presence and absence. I could only entrust myself to his words. Warily, I stepped into the cave. Then it struck me. I had been here before. I knew this cave by sight. The air inside was familiar too. Memories came flooding back. The wind cave on Mount Fuji. The cave where our young uncle had taken Komichi and me during our summer break, back when we were kids. She had slipped into a narrow side tunnel and disappeared for a long while. I had been scared to death that she was gone for good. Had she been sucked into an underground maze for all eternity?
Eternity is a very long time, the faceless man had said. I walked slowly through the cave toward the yellow light, deadening my footsteps and trying to quiet my pounding heart. I rounded a corner, and there it was, the source of the light. An old lantern with a black metal rim, the sort that coal miners once carried, hanging on a thick nail driven into the stone wall. A fat candle burned inside the lantern. Lantern, I thought. The word had come up not long before. It was part of the name of the anti-Nazi underground student organization that Tomohiko Amada was presumed to have joined. Things seemed to be converging. A woman was standing beneath the lantern. I didn't see her at first because she was so tiny, less than 2 feet tall. Her black hair was coiled atop her head in a neat bun, and she wore a white gown from some ancient time. Its elegance was apparent at a glance. Another character lifted from Killing Commendatore, the beautiful maiden who looks on in horror, her hand over her mouth, as the Commendatore is slain. In Mozart's Don Giovanni, she is Donna Anna, the daughter of the Commendatore. Magnified by the light of the lantern, her sharp black shadow trembled on the wall of the cave.
I have been awaiting you, the miniature Donna Anna said.
Chapter 55. A Clear Contravention of Basic Principles.
I have been awaiting you, said Donna Anna. She was tiny, but her voice was clear and bright.
Nothing could have surprised me by that point. It even seemed natural for her to be there waiting for me. She was a beautiful woman with an innate elegance, and the way she spoke had a majestic ring. She might be only 2 feet tall, but she clearly had that special something that could captivate a man.
I will be your guide, she said to me. Please be so kind as to take that lantern.
I unhooked the lantern from the wall. I didn't know who had put it there, so far beyond her reach. Its circular metal handle allowed it to be hung on a nail or carried by hand. You were waiting for me? I asked.
Yes, she said. For a very long time.
Could she be another form of metaphor? I hesitated to pose such a bold question. Do you live in these parts?
Live here? She said, casting a dubious glance in my direction. No, I am here to meet you. And I'm afraid I don't understand what you mean by these parts.
I gave up asking questions after that. She was Donna Anna, and she had been waiting for me. She wore the same sort of ancient garb as the Commendatore, in her case, a white garment most likely made of fine silk. Draped in layers over the top half of her body, with loose-fitting pantaloons below. Though her shape was therefore hidden, I guessed she was slender but strong. Her small black shoes were fashioned of leather of some kind.
Then let us commence, Dona Ana said to me. Not much time remains. The path is narrowing as we speak. Please follow me, and be so good as to hold the lantern. I followed in her wake, holding the lantern above her head. She walked toward the back of the cave with quick, practiced steps. The candle's flame fluttered as we moved, casting a dancing mosaic of shadows on the pitted walls. This looks like a wind cave on Mount Fuji that I once visited, I said. Is that possible? All that is here looks like something, Dona Ana declaimed without turning around, as though she were addressing the darkness ahead. Do you mean to say nothing here is the real thing? No one can tell what is or is not the real thing, she stated flatly. All that we see is a product of connectivity. Light here is a metaphor for shadow, shadow a metaphor for light. You know this already, I believe. I didn't think I knew, at least not all that well, but I refrained from inquiring further. That could only lead to more knotty abstractions. The cave grew narrower the farther back we went. The roof became lower too, so that I had to stoop as I walked, just as I had done in the Mount Fuji wind cave. Finally, Dona Ana drew to a halt and turned to face me. Her small, flashing eyes stared up into mine. I can guide you this far. Now you must take the lead. I will follow, but only to a certain point. After that, you are on your own. Take the lead? I shook my head in disbelief. From what I could see, we had reached the very back of the cave. A dark stone wall blocked our way. I passed the lantern across its face, but it appeared that we had hit a dead end. It seems we can't go any farther, I said. Please look again. There should be an opening in the corner to your left, Dona Ana said. I shone the lantern on that section of the cave wall once more. When I stuck my head out and looked more closely, I could make out a dark depression on the far side of a large boulder. I squeezed myself between the wall and the boulder to inspect it. It certainly did appear to be an opening. I remembered my sister slipping into an even narrower crack. I turned back to Dona Ana. You must enter there, the 2-foot-tall woman said. I looked at her lovely face, wondering what to say. On the wall, her elongated shadow flickered in the lantern's yellow light. I am fully aware, she said, that you have been terrified of small dark places all your life. In such places you can no longer breathe normally. I am correct, am I not? Nevertheless, you must force yourself to enter. Only in such a manner can you grasp that which you seek. Where does this opening lead? I do not know. The destination is something you yourself must determine by following your own heart. But fear is in my heart as well, I said. That's what worries me, that my fear will distort what I see and push me in the wrong direction. Once again, it is you who determines the path. You are the one who chose the proper route to reach this world. You paid a great price for that, and have crossed the river by boat. You cannot turn back now. I looked again at the opening. I shuddered to think I would have to crawl into that dark, cramped tunnel. Yet that was what I had to do. She was right. I couldn't turn back now. I placed the lantern on the ground and took the flashlight from my pocket. A lantern would be much too cumbersome in that tiny space. Believe in yourself, Dona Ana said, her voice small but penetrating. You have drunk from the river, have you not? Yes, I was very thirsty. It is good that you did so, Dona Ana said. That river flows along the interstice between presence and absence. It is filled with hidden possibilities that only the finest metaphors can bring to the surface. Just as a great poet can use one scene to bring another new unknown vista into view. It should be obvious, but the best metaphors make the best poems. Take good care not to avert your eyes from the new unknown vistas you will encounter.
Tomohiko Amada's Killing Commendatore might be seen as one such unknown vista. Like a great poem, the painting was a perfect metaphor, one that launched a new reality into the world. I switched on the flashlight and checked its beam. It was bright and unwavering. The batteries should last for some time yet. I removed my leather jacket. It was too bulky to fit into such a tight space. That left me wearing a light sweater and jeans. The cave wasn't especially cold, but neither was it all that warm. Bracing myself, I crouched until I was almost on all fours and squeezed head first into the opening. Inside, I found what appeared to be a tunnel sunk into solid rock. It was smooth to the touch, as if worn by water over the course of many years. There were almost no jagged or protruding edges. As a result, despite its narrowness, I was able to progress more easily than I had expected. The rock was cool and slightly damp. I inched forward on my stomach like a worm, the flashlight illuminating my way. I figured that the tunnel must have functioned as a waterway at some point in the past. The tunnel was about 2 feet high and 3 feet across. Crawling was the only option. It looked like it would go on forever, a dark, natural pipe that expanded and contracted by small degrees. Sometimes it curved to the side. At other times it sloped up or down. Thankfully, though, there were no abrupt rises or falls. Then it hit me. If this was an underground conduit, water could flood the tunnel at any moment, and I would surely drown. My legs stopped moving, paralyzed by fear. I wanted to turn around and go back the way I had come, but it was impossible to reverse course in such a cramped space. The tunnel seemed to have grown even narrower. Crawling backward to where I had begun was out of the question. Terror engulfed me. I was literally nailed to the spot. I couldn't move forward and I couldn't retreat. Every cell in my body cried out for fresh air. Forsaken by light, I felt powerless and alone. "Do not stop. You must push on." Donna Anna's command was irrefutable. I couldn't tell if I was hearing things, or if she was really behind me, urging me on. "I can't move," I gasped, squeezing out the words. "And I can't breathe." "Make fast your heart," said Donna Anna. "Do not let it flounder. Should that happen, you will surely fall prey to a double metaphor."
"What are double metaphors?" I asked.
"You should know the answer to that already."
"I should know?"
"That is because they are within you," said Donna Anna. "They grab hold of your true thoughts and feelings and devour them one after another, fattening themselves. That is what double metaphors are. They have been dwelling in the depths of your psyche since ancient times."
Unbidden, the man with the white Subaru Forester entered my mind. I didn't want him there, but there was no way around it. It was he who had pushed me to throttle that young woman, forcing me to look into the darkness of my own heart. He had reappeared more than once to make sure I would remember that darkness. "I know where you were and what you were doing," he was announcing to me. Of course he knew everything, because he lived inside me. My heart was in chaos. I closed my eyes and tried to anchor it, to hold it in one place. I ground my teeth with the effort.
But how should I go about securing my heart? Where was its true location anyway? I looked within myself, searching one place after another, but it didn't turn up. Where could it be? Your true heart lives in your memory. It is nourished by the images it contains. That's how it lives, a woman said. This time, however, it was not Donna Anna speaking. It was Komi, my sister, dead at age 12. Search your memory, said that dear voice. Find something concrete, something you can touch. Komi, I said. There was no answer. Komi, where are you? I said. Still no reply. There in the dark, I searched my memory, like rummaging through an old duffel bag, but it seemed to have been emptied. I couldn't even recall exactly what memory was. Turn off your light and listen to the wind, Komi said. I switched off the flashlight, but I couldn't hear the wind, though I tried. All I could make out was the restless pounding of my heart, a screen door banging in a gale. Listen to the wind, Komi repeated. Once again, I held my breath and focused. This time, I could hear, lying beyond my heartbeat, a faint humming. A wind seemed to be blowing somewhere far away. A wisp of a breeze brushed my face. Air was entering the tunnel ahead. Air I could smell. The unmistakable odor of damp soil. The first odor I had encountered since setting foot in this land of metaphor. The tunnel was leading somewhere. To a place I could smell. In short, to the real world. All right, then. On you go, said Donna Anna. There isn't much time left. With my flashlight turned off, I crawled on into the blackness. As I moved forward, I tried to draw even the slightest whiff of that real air into my lungs. Komi? I asked again. There was no answer. I ransacked my store of memories. Komi and I had raised a pet cat, a smart black tomcat. We named it Koyasu, though why we gave it that name escapes me. Komi had picked it up as a kitten on her way home from school. One day, however, it disappeared. We scoured our neighborhood looking for it. We stopped countless people and showed them Koyasu's photograph. But in the end, the cat never turned up. I crawled on, the image of the black cat vivid in my mind. I tried to imagine my sister and me together, searching for it. I strained my eyes to catch a glimpse of the cat at the end of the dark tunnel. I pricked my ears to hear its mewing. The black cat was solid and concrete, something I could touch. I could feel its fur, its warmth, the firmness of its body, even hear it purr, as if it were yesterday. That's right, Komi said. Just keep remembering like that. I know where you were and what you were doing, the man with the white Subaru Forester called out of nowhere. He wore a black leather jacket and a golf cap with a Yonexa logo. His voice was hoarse from the sea wind. Caught by surprise, I recoiled in fear. I tried to find my memories of the cat, to draw the fragrance of damp earth into my lungs. I seemed to recall that smell from somewhere, from a time not so far away, but I couldn't remember, try as I might, where had it been? As I struggled to recall, once again, my memories began to fade away. Strangle me with this, the girl had said. Her pink tongue peeked out at me from between her lips. The belt of her bathrobe lay beside her pillow, ready to be used. Her pubic hair glistened like grass in the rain. Come on, Komi urged me. Call up a favorite memory. Hurry! I tried to bring back the black cat, but Koyasu was gone. Why couldn't I remember him? Perhaps the darkness had snatched him away while I was distracted. Its power had devoured him.